Welcome to The Safety Break, the Whitewater Rescue Podcast. We're here to share stories of real river accidents and rescues and find expert advice on how to solve the problems you might encounter in the Whitewater River environment. I'm your host, Jack Diddy, an emergency medicine physician, whitewater paddler, and wilderness medicine educator. Together, I hope we can celebrate successful rescues and learn from our mistakes in a supportive environment. If you have a story to share of a non-fatal accident or rescue, send me an email at thesafetybreak@gmail.com or contact me on our Facebook page, The Safety Break. If you like what you hear, hit the subscribe button and follow us on social media. I hope you learned something valuable in the show.
Was really why we went, you know, like oh, North Fork's running higher than it's ever run. Well, we're 5 hours away. This is a natural direction to go. Let's head over there.
I could feel myself like going under. I could feel my like, I felt like I was just cartwheeling underwater, kind of like taking a ski fall or something where you're just like ragdolling down the river.
Just knowing where everyone on your group is huge. Fortunately, I didn't know where he was, and so I stopped to figure it out. And I'm so glad I did.
If you spend much time exploring big mountains, you'll be familiar with the concept of the no-fall zone. These are generally narrow ledges or steep slopes with lots of vertical exposure. One slip, and you fall into the abyss with certain injury or death waiting. Paddling rivers at extremely high water is the whitewater equivalent of this. Swims at these flows can be brutal and sometimes fatal. Every instruction book or whitewater course tells you to avoid high water scenarios, and that recommendation exists for good reason. But sometimes we choose to paddle this type of water because we feel confident and we want to push our limits and have an incredibly fun experience while doing so. Other times we blunder into it, either misjudging the flow at the put-in or facing a rising level while already committed to the run, which is usually a terrifying experience. In general, if it's pouring rain and creeks are still rising, it's best to wait a few hours or a day to let the level stabilize and let some of the debris and maybe some of the E. coli flush downstream. It's also good to have some situational awareness and consideration for the communities that you're visiting. If it's truly a disastrous flood event, do everyone a favor and sit that one out. It can lead to some unnecessary conflict if you're out recreating while homes and cars are being flushed downstream. As rivers reach bankful levels and beyond, the water dynamics change, and you really feel this if you're swimming in it. The fastest current is typically in the middle of the channel, with debris like trees, trash, and you, if you're the swimmer, funneled to this area. If you try to swim to shore, there can be reactionary waves and strong eddy lines which reject you back to the middle channel. And in this middle channel are often tall waves. Your PFD won't always float you to the top of these, so you get repeatedly dunked underwater through the peaks. Downstream visibility is limited, and you may be speeding quickly towards rocks, big holes, or the numerous strainers that would usually be out of play at normal flow. All in all, it's a recipe for drowning. If you choose to paddle at ultra-high flows, you got to be at the top of your game, in great aerobic condition, and you can't afford to make a mistake. In this episode, we're going to hear about a high-water swim, the lessons learned, and the things you should consider if you choose to partake in this aspect of the sport. Let's meet our guests and hear the story from Jeff Cluel and Drew Austell.
My name is Jeff Cluel. I started paddling for the most part in North Carolina and like the French Broad and Nolichucky Rivers in right around 2005. Spent a bunch of years down there, and then I moved out to the White Salmon area in 2010. And I've been there ever since. Moved to Portland in like 2019.
Yeah, I'm Drew Austell. I live in Asheville. Really been kayaking my whole adult life. Also, for much of my adult life, I was a whitewater river guide, and I was at the time working on the white salmon. I looked back at my paddling log, which I kept religiously for about 6 or 7 years, and it was like every day that for the months preceding that. And Jeff was paddling with me a bunch too, because we were living in the same place and we were good buddies. And I mean, it was not like I was paddling every day. It was like I would go and do 2 laps on the Little White, and then I'd go work a raft trip, and then I'd go do like a farmlands and a green truss lap. You know, like I was just like, from the moment I feel like we woke up till we went to bed, we were if we weren't raft guiding, we were kayaking. There was no breaks. It was tip top. It was, you know, the best paddling that I had been doing probably at that point, really probably anywhere in my life. Both from a quality standpoint, because we had really good water that year, everything was high. You know, we would run the green truss like 4 or 5 feet. I mean, like some fairly stratospheric levels, especially then. And then we'd go back and do it again. And then we'd go run the little white, you know, 3 or 4 feet, whatever it was just nonstop. And of course we were there at the North Fork and it was super high. And that just kind of felt like you just expected that everything was going to be high. That was what was really why we went, you know, like, oh, North Fork's running higher than it's ever run. Well, we're 5 hours away. This is a natural direction to go. Let's head over there.
The North Fork of the Payette is a popular class 5 run just north of Boise, Idaho. It has dependable dam release flows in the summertime, and with its close proximity to many other big water runs, it might just be the center of the big water kayaking universe. It has powerful water and a continuous downhill tilt to the stream bed. So even at standard flows of around 2000 CFS, it's not the kind of place you want to be out of your boat.
The whitewater section that's best known on the North Fork is about 15 miles long, but it's got pretty steep gradient. I couldn't tell you offhand. I want to say about 120 feet per mile. So it's not like steep creek, but they put a railroad on one side. And to do that, they blasted the grade and filled down into the river. And they put the highway, that main highway that goes north-south in Idaho on the other side, and blasted the grade and filled in. So the river's like, I've always imagined it as being about a fraction of the width it should be. So you feel like you're even at regular flows, which would be 1500, 2500, I think 3000 CFS is about where they start calling it kind of high. Even at regular flows, you feel like you're in like a pressurized water hose. Like the water's got nowhere to go. It's just flying. The rapids will be like a mile long. And I remember people would joke around about it's so much whitewater and you go for so far and it's so sunny that like your eyes get all bloodshot and whacked out. And you know, you like, you have to train yourself to breathe because you'll go for a mile and you're just getting splashed in the face all the time. And you're like, man, I'm kind of hypoxic because I literally haven't been breathing because I'm just getting splashed in the face all the time. You have to like strategically breathe. And that's just at regular flows. And then I think when we got there, and it was probably around June 10th or something, it was at like 9,000. There had been some glitch at the dam that created like fairly intensely high water, way higher than it's ever supposed to be released at. I think they had to release so high to preserve the dam. All the kayakers were just freaking out. I remember some video footage that came from that day where it was not us paddling, but they were chasing the kayakers on the highway, hanging out the window with like a real fancy camera, and they're keeping pace with the kayakers, getting like highway footage. They were going highway speed, you know, down the whitewater. Cause the river really couldn't spread out just the way it was built in from the sides. It was, quite an experience to show up there in peak form. And, you know, everyone who's on the river there is the best in the world. Those Idaho guys are so good and they're all bugged out and everyone's, you know, like kind of bonding together about it. That's kind of the scene that we rolled in on, was this like uber high water, maybe never to be replicated event, kind of while at peak form paddling.
Yeah, it was like probably among the best shape of my life. I'd been paddling almost every single day in May and June, like paddling probably some of the hardest whitewater I ever had. Feeling great. I think I got out there on the 11th. We paddled like the lower five at like, I was looking at levels at probably somewhere between like 7 and 9,000. Spent the next 2 days on the Sea Sesh and the South Fork, and the Main Salmon, doing that like overnight. And then I came back for 2 more days on the North Fork and we did like the lower seven those days. So we put in like right below golf course. I think you get like screaming left there. And then pretty soon thereafter, you turn the corner and go into Jaws.
The rapid's called Jaws, and it's not the biggest rapid out there, but it's one of the longest. The flows are maybe 6,500. We'd been there about 5 days and it had been dropping. And honestly, if you ask me, I think it got a little harder at 6,500, like not quite as fast, but everything had teeth. The waves are crashing a little harder and the lines are a little tighter. But the Jaws move is this pretty intense entry move. And I, you know, it's all just big. You're not really running a drop but it's just big. And when the waves break on you, it's like the force of a truck landing on you. And so you make it through the entry move, and then you just have this enormous mile long wave train that goes from there, without a ton of technicality in the lower part. There's a little bit as you get further down into that mile long stretch. You kind of had to like get through these breaking waves that kind of guard the beginning of the rapid and then ride out the fun part. And what I remember from talking with Jeff in hindsight was he didn't get through one of those breaking waves. It just completely, it was called getting teabagged. He got teabagged, and just like, you know, it's like when the water gets in every orifice, like folds your eyelids inside out and, you know, fills your ears and your mouth. And it just like, just shredded him and ripped his paddle out of his hand and just left him completely discombobulated in the biggest white water that either of us had ever paddled in, for sure. And so that led to him swimming. So, like from the top, like at the top of the rapid. So worst case scenario, for sure.
There's three big features. And the first big feature was like a compression wave. And the day before it had set me up, like kind of wheeled me onto my stern, but it leveled out the day before, and it was scary but fun. And then this time as I came down on my stern, it flipped me backwards. When I went to roll, I must've gone into a hole or dropped over a ledge or something, but my paddle was just gone instantly. And it pretty quickly spiraled out from there. I think I tried one hand. I definitely panicked. I think I tried one hand roll. I'd like to at least say that I did. That wasn't working. And, so I swam. So I came out of the boat. It was just me and one other person. It was just me and Drew that day. So I kind of knew that I was on my own, that it was going to be a while. And when I popped up, our men pretty much booked it straight for shore, which I think was a critical mistake at that point in the river. Given how big it was, I don't think there was much chance that I was going to make it to the side. So I think I should have just kind of conserved energy there and taken the swim a little bit longer and gotten out in it's not really a pool, but in the slack waters, either between the big sections or towards the bottom of the rapid. But I booked it to shore. I got pretty close and then was instantly reminded of helical flow. So as you get to that side, it's almost like a corkscrew. If you laid a corkscrew down on the bank of the river, where I got close to the edge and then was immediately picked up and then set back into the middle of the river. It is just nonstop. Like it just goes and goes and goes and just waves for days. And I wish I had been a little bit more familiar with it, because I think that would have changed a few of the things that I would have done on like during that swim to preserve a little bit of energy. Like I was trying to like downstream ferry towards the edge, not wasting any energy, like fighting the current going upstream, just trying to keep the momentum of going downstream and trying to build up some like lateral momentum to get over to the edge. I think I had done some like swift water courses at that point. So I was like ready to like find eddy lines and like spin on eddy lines, but it's so surgy too, that I couldn't really make out a whole lot as I'm coming over the crests of waves. I felt like I was going through most of the waves. In my notes, I have just a little phrase of like, this is what flush drowning feels like. Cause I could feel myself like going under. I could feel I felt like I was just cartwheeling underwater. Kind of like taking a ski fall or something, where you're just like ragdolling down the river, and I could feel my feet kind of like go into the air, and then I could like get my body spun around, and I'd like my helmet would come up, and then I'd be back into the next wave. So I was getting up to the surface, but not with any predictability. I did at one point in the swim come back to like reunite with my boat, which was a brief rest. Climbed on top of it. It was upside down. But then the first hole we went into, as we were separated again.
As Jeff mentioned, he's basically describing flush drowning. It's one of the more common causes of whitewater paddler fatalities, accounting for 19% of these in the American Whitewater Accident Database. In the past few years, there's been some misconceptions and disagreement in how we define what flush drowning is, but I think we can find a common sense understanding of it here. From a physiologic standpoint, the end result is the same as drowning in general, respiratory impairment due to submersion. The term flush drowning just describes the mechanism by which the submersion is occurring. It's a repetitive or prolonged submersion due to continuous swift current, which prevents the swimmer's attempt to get to shore. The swimmer may have disorganized breathing from the intense physical exertion, from panic, or in some cases from the cold water shock response, which can cause involuntary gasping breaths. We'll talk more about this cold water issue in an upcoming episode. The key feature of flush drowning, though, is that the swimmer is essentially trapped in the flow of the river and frequently encountering waves or hydraulics that sap their strength and lead to progressive respiratory compromise. This tends to occur on rivers with continuous stream beds with few eddies, or in long complex rapids, or on any river at high water.
I couldn't tell you how far in front of him I was, because you peel out of an eddy and immediately you're just downstream so fast. I'm paddling down through these huge waves and feeling good, but you have these like split seconds to like check on your buddy at the top of every wave. You know, you get to the top of a wave, you get this big splash in the face. And if you're lucky, you can whip around behind you, like look behind you really quick and see if you can catch a glimpse of the guy you're paddling with, in this case of Jeff. And then you're back down in the trough of a wave. And in the few opportunities I had as I'm flying downstream, still trying to like actually, you know, not get crushed myself, I wouldn't see him at each glance. But I also was like, well, you have like maybe less than a second to hope to catch like a flash of color or something. And it could be you're just like on the offbeat, like he's in a trough of one wave while I'm at the peak of another wave. And you can go quite a ways and maybe not see someone in that big of a whitewater, which is somewhat unique, unless you're paddling a lot of big whitewater. I think people that have will recognize that as a thing. But what was particularly unique here is that rapid is just so long. You're just going through these waves that are enormous for so long. And so I had this sense after just a few minutes, because I've now traveled, you know, in less than a minute, you've traveled, you know, half a mile, maybe, I don't know. You're going so fast. But I had this like spidey sense that I just hadn't seen him after a few shots, and I should have. And I was like, God, I hope he's not swimming, you know? And, at the time it was more just like, I need to find an eddy or something, a place to stop so that I can like verify that he's still upright and in his boat and just on the offbeat, like that I haven't seen him because he's low in the trough when I'm high. And I did somehow manage to find a spot there on the river. It was kind of like a one random spot where the river spread out a little, and there's this kind of like shallow boulder braid that's normally just like a rocky, chunky island, but it was totally covered. But it created like a, you know, an eddy-ish kind of spot, a break in the full force of the river. When I pulled over there, I quickly saw him swimming down towards me at that point. He kind of ended up swimming over the same boulder braid, which was probably terrible because he basically was like in the middle of being flush drowned and then was like getting pounded over shallow rocks at the same time. But I was able to connect with him right there in the center of the river and communicate that he needed to grab my boat and start, start getting him to shore.
Once I got to him, having since taught a lot of rescue courses, and you teach people a lot about like near drownings and how those people react to anything that floats, it was pretty instinctual to grab on. Like, I mean, it's pretty thankful to have the design of the boat the way it was. Like, I had two awesome grab loops, and I think working when you have like two people that know, you can kind of like, you know, if I'm dragging him down and he's like starting to roll, I can like let go of one side and help him control the boat. But it felt pretty easy to hang on to and pretty smooth. It did not feel like we were making a ton of progress towards the shore, but I don't know. I hope that I was helping to kick him to shore, but I was pretty gassed by the time I got to his boat. I remember just coughing. I'd probably taken on a lot of water.
I was in a creek boat. It was a Nomad, so it had those good handles kind of up near the back of the cockpit. He was able to get a fair bit of his body out, but it's, you know, you're towing someone who's 200 pounds. That's hard. It's slow and your boat doesn't track the right way. You know, you're kind of in a back ender. We caught the last available stopping point. It's hard to even call it an eddy, because again, you got just chunky boulder riverbank. It's not natural. And so there's little pockets in those boulders that you can kind of get over, but it's really just a flush. But we caught the last thing that we could have caught before we would have gone into houndstooth, which is what makes this kind of a scary event to look back on. Because from houndstooth down, it's just nonstop again. It would have been a significantly graver situation. It was grave at the time, but it would have been much much more serious. And maybe, you know, Jeff, if you ask Jeff, he'll tell you that if we hadn't caught that eddy, he wouldn't have made it, that he was on his last legs. I had a different perspective. I was, you know, feeling invincible and just was like, ah, I'm pulling my buddy ashore, you know, keep kicking, Jeff. And so we talk about this sometimes and he's like, man, that was it. Like I was thinking about flush drowning then. That was what was going through my head. And I was like, I was just pulling you to shore. And I tell him, we argue. I'm like, we don't know what would have happened, but it's a little bit tough to kind of face that sometimes.
I think once I made it to the bank, I remember being pretty relieved and I felt like, I was like, I think I'm okay. Pretty happy to be on any sort of non-moving water close to dry land. Pretty soon after that, we kind of checked in and Drew was like, are you okay? And I was like, I think I am. He's like, you want me to get your boat? Like, sure. I wasn't really making decisions, but I would love to not lose the boat on the day. So he ended up like soloing the next five, looking for the boat. He found the boat, got the boat to shore. We never got the paddle back, but yeah, once I got to shore, I wasn't thinking about any sort of like aspiration or anything. I was still coughing. I was still getting some stuff up, but I felt like did a little body scan and I was like, yeah, I think I'll just go up to the road and hitch and see you at the takeout.
Ultimately, Jeff came out unscathed, but maybe a little wiser. Let's hear from Jeff and Drew about the lessons they learned that day.
So Drew and I have talked about this for a while, and it's always been like my line where I feel like he saved my life there. Like I do not think I would have been able to get out of that river without my paddling partner. Paddling with people that are watching out for you, even on our simple sections, even on our class three daily runs, you stay close, don't get too far out. You're watching in the spots that you know, and paddling with people that you trust and you know are looking out for you, and that you're looking out for the people you're paddling with. Also, I think about just like river familiarity and run familiarity. You know, like that was my second time ever seeing that rapid. So I had no sense of like, okay, this is like, these are my outs. I didn't even really think of the river in that way. Like maybe I was lulled into well, it's roadside. So like, you don't have to think about logistics as like, extrication logistics as much, but like knowing, being more intimately familiar with this run at this stage. These are like, if something happens here, like thinking through those scenarios a little bit more, which is something I found myself like when I'm like coaching people or working with people on rivers, like if something happens here, like just float, like there's a big pool downstream, or like, kind of giving them a little bit more context. So I think I would have a much better chance if I conserved a little bit at the beginning of the swim, like through the big stuff, and just try to like keep holding my breath, not take on any water. And then as I got through some of the bigger stuff to get out more towards the slack water.
I think we were well prepared to be there, but a swim like that takes a different level of preparation. Some people probably prepare for kind of the epic swims, but most people probably don't. When we would give trip talks on rafting trips to people that have no idea what they're getting into, if the water was really high, we would talk about preserve, conserve. I think we called it defensive swimming, where instead of like using all your energy to get to shore, you're just like hanging out, preserving your energy, breathing when you can, holding your breath when you need to, and how you can just go so much longer that way. And that can apply, I think, in this kind of situation. We used to joke, I say used to because I take it a little more seriously now, but sometimes something would get really high and you couldn't find anyone else to boat with you. No one else wanted to do it. And like, when that happened to me, I would sometimes just go by myself. I remember paddling the Green Truss at Richter levels, because no one else even wanted to go. And I like justified it by saying, well, if you're swimming in that flow, doesn't matter who you're with, you know, you're on your own anyway. But then I think we kind of proved in a way, every situation's so different, but we proved in a way that actually that's a bit naive. Like someone else out there really, really can help you, because I don't think Jeff was getting ashore on his own. And from that point forward, I actually started scaling it back. You know, it was not because of Jeff's swim. It was more just my recognition that like, I didn't want to paddle anything harder than that. And until that week and those levels on that river, I had not felt that way. Probably tied in some part to my age and where I was going, you know, in other parts of life. But I'm so glad I went and did it. I'd kind of been looking for that, right? And after Jeff swam, I went back and ran the whole thing top to bottom again, and then did the lower seven again, same day.
I love hearing Drew describe how they were just drinking it all in, running lap after lap, all day long, almost every day. Many of us have been there at one time or another in our paddling lives, just never able to get enough of it. If you're in that kind of mindset right now and paddling this kind of water, let's recap the things you need to keep in mind. Of course, the prerequisite for all of this is an absolutely bomb-proof roll so you don't end up swimming in the first place. And you need to know that no matter how talented and experienced of a paddler you are, once you're swimming in the river, it's a completely different sport at that point. You need to have great aerobic conditioning and strong whitewater swimming ability. It's worth practicing this in safer environments. There's also some issues regarding cold water that we'll discuss in an upcoming episode. I think Jeff and Drew mentioned most of the other salient points. Conserving energy while swimming, knowing the river so you anticipate problem spots and exit points, making sure you have a solid crew and that you're all looking out for each other. Finally, if you're not feeling right about the water level, about the crew that you're with, or about your own abilities and conditioning, don't be afraid to walk away. Your future self will appreciate these good decisions. Thanks for listening again today. I posted some video links on our Facebook site showing the payout at these high flows and some other video links about flush drowning. We've got more episodes coming soon, so stay safe out there, and I hope to see you on the river.
Thank you for listening to The Safety Break, the Whitewater Rescue Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, hit the subscribe button and click follow on our Facebook page so that we know that you're out there. I'm also looking for more stories. If you know of an interesting non-fatal river accident or rescue, send me a few details by email, safetybreak@gmail.com. It doesn't have to be dramatic or life-threatening, just something that we all might be able to learn from. I'll see if we can turn it into an episode. Stay safe out there, and I hope to see you on the river.